Late Night Live. Ideas and opinions from around the world.
G'day Gladys and Potties, welcome to Late Night Live, and tonight it comes from Van Diemen's Land, where I talked to its most famous author, Richard Flanagan. It actually happened last night in a very, very interesting situation. What I'm about to say is completely redundant for the audience sitting here in the Theatre Royal, but is necessary for those who aren't. It is our great pleasure to be sitting in the most beautiful theatre in Australia, the Theatre Royal in Tasmania, in one of the most charming cities on the face of the earth. And I refer, of course, to Hobart. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this theatre, and I grabbed this brochure from the foyer before I came in, dates, of course, to the 1830s, and amongst the recent performances, well, performers in modern times, Olivia, Lee, Gladys Moncrief, some of you may not recognise the name, but she was Australia's Queen of Song, Jack Davey, Michael Redgrave, Spike Milligan, June Bronhill, Barry Humphreys, Prunella Scales, and tonight the limelight and the spotlight falls on Richard Flanagan. Richard, welcome.
Lovely to be here, Philip.
Talking to the microphone, Sam. Now,
he's a pro.
It will emerge how appropriate the venue is a little later, because one of the central characters in Richard's book is Charles Dickens, who would have been very familiar with spaces like this. He was obsessed with the theatre.
Yeah, he was. He saw himself for a long time more as an actor than as a writer, but he was actually a poor actor, although he took coaching. But I was interested in this novel in writing in part about the dilemmas and difficulties of writing, because I think it's something that's little understood out there. And so this story offered me the chance to do that.
We'll get around to the novel a little later. What I want to do, as I warned you backstage, is think and talk about writing itself. Many, many years ago, I worked on a commercial radio station I never mentioned called 2UE with people whose names never passed my lips, like John Laws, Alan Jones and Stan Zemanek. But late at night, I was allowed to come on air and just sort of mumble on about anything. And they'd find the oddest guests for me, and often I had no idea who they were when they walked in. And one of them, and I've written it down in my hand because I had to be reminded by Richard, was Julian Barnes. Now, at the time, Julian was just getting famous. You know, it hadn't quite happened. And he's sitting opposite me, and I didn't really know what to ask him. So I put a very simple question to him. I said, "Why do you write?" And there was a long silence. And he looked at me, and he said, "Because I'm afraid of dying." And he told me later, off air, he'd never really thought about that. Now, of course, his writing is overwhelmed by death. I'm going to put the same question to you. There's lots of reasons to write: for a living, for therapy, to amuse, to entertain, to attract women. You know, there's lots of... Why do you write?
Well, I think if I could sing it or dance it, if I could paint it, if I could spit it, you know, I'd do it, but I can't do any of those things. I'm inept at just about everything, and the only thing I seemed to ever have a talent for was writing. And I guess it was... there is an aspect of it that is a defence against nothingness. It is an ark in which you gather everything dear to you, everything you've ever loved, all the people, animals, plants, places, all the dead and all the living. But I think it was... There's a thing I saw once, this interview with Elvis near his death, and they said, "Why do you sing?" And he said, "When I sing, I feel like I'm touched by God." And Elvis was a very ordinary man who did sing like an angel. But I think you come to discover sometimes if you do these things that although you may not believe in God, and I don't, it can be the best of you, and it is the thing that joins you with others. So I'm not sure if I don't write because of a fear of death, but in the end it is the thing that joins me in the best way I know with other people. And
you need to be joined to other people, because you find writing, and you choose to write in a comparatively lonely place, you find writing a very lonely, isolating experience.
Well, writing is an isolating thing to do, but as Faulkner said, you should live in a monastery by day and a brothel by night if you're a writer. So I try and seek out all aspects of human experience.
As far as I know, there isn't a substantial brothel on Bruny Island.
The Bruny Island Progress Association will welcome any suggestions you might have, Philip. There's a big push on to get visitors there at the moment. Mm. I can't say I wholeheartedly endorse it or the things you're proposing, but
we were nattering backstage about a writer that we both admire, Carpentier, who bears the burden of virtually inventing magical realism, and we were chatting about it, and you were talking about another writer in that tradition who was describing a concert where the audience got so excited by the music that they came and ate the orchestra one at a time. And I said to you that it seems to me that a writer often eats himself, that you feed on your own flesh.
Well, yeah, I think that there is a corrosive aspect to writing, and often writers feel not a sense of growth and development, but a sense of diminishment. And there's a beautiful essay by F. Scott Fitzgerald called The Crack-Up, which he wrote near the end of his time. And in it he talks about how he in the end has become less. He's become a person, the sort of man he despised as a young man. He's become needy. He's become a user. And it's because all that was best in him he gave to his stories, and now he's got nothing left. And I think there are many writers who end up feeling that way.
It puzzles me sometimes the way writers often feel persecuted, beleaguered, lonely, and yet in our society, in Australia, in 21st century Australia, and you can see it vividly at Writers' Weeks, the writer, particularly the novelist, is almost sanctified.
Well, I think there's two worlds. There's the world of reading and writing, and and then there's the world of writers' festivals, and they're sort of an upper-middle-class circus, and Godspeed to them, and people seem to have a very pleasant time in them, but they do take on odd religious overtones sometimes. And
but that shows there is a need out there. There's a need that the audience, the reader has, and it's not getting any the less, despite all the funny new ways there are to amuse and distract, including riding motorbikes very loudly past the Theatre Royal.
Well, I think books, you know, all my life, well, look, all the time I've been writing, I've kept on reading about the death of the novel, the end of books. But books, to me, seem to become more powerful and more necessary, because as the avenues for truth close down everywhere else around us, as they become taken over by power and money, books are one of the last things we have left where one person can express their own truth. And if they can do it with enough craft and honesty, they will be heard across the continents, and they will be heard through time. So they become more remarkable rather than less remarkable, I think.
This is my Bible. We're both atheists, but I have a Bible. It's called the New York Review of Books. And here is John Banville, who's both a novelist and a pretty good critic, reviewing James Wood. And he says, "What is fiction for? This is one of those questions. How does a compassionate God permit cruelty? What do women want? Why is there dandruff?" Which are probably not susceptible of an answer, but which yet to continue to niggle. At the simplest, we may observe that inside every adult there lives on a child who must have stories that thrill or soothe, and that even the novels of the grandest seriousness are no more than elaborated fairy tales. Now, I was a late comer to your writing, as you know. I listened to recorded books on my long nocturnal journeys, and one of them was a brilliant reading of Gould. And although I'm resistant to magical realism, I was so overwhelmed by this fairy story for this adult that I wrote you something I rarely do. I wrote you a fan letter.
You did. A very kind fan letter.
Yeah.
I think you were more taken by the voice than the words.
Though. Well, no, I think it was a wonderful read, I'll tell you that. And when you win the Nobel Prize, I think you should give him at least the pedestal. But I come back to this thing of the needs that we have. We all need stories, don't we, from the earliest childhood?
Well, stories... It's interesting you should read that from John Bamble, because I met up with him for a while in Italy. He came to this bizarre place where I was staying in Tuscany with a crazed contessa who invited writers into her Tuscan retreat, and he was there for a couple of days. And he, at the time, he had a belief that the novel was really over and the best work had been done in the 19th century, but clearly he's somewhat altered his view. And it is true that novels, poetry, art, as Auden said somewhere, are good for nothing, but we need something. We understand there is a mystery within us that isn't... We can't apprehend by any other means other than stories, because stories are open, like humour, and they never close off to a final fixed opinion. They're beyond ideology. They're beyond politics. They're the only things that again and again remind us of all that we share with others. And they remind us that everybody's possessed of this chaos within them.
Are they beyond time?
I think the great stories are beyond time. I mean, the forms they get told in, you know, that they're subject to the ravages of time. But the great stories have a soul that seems to survive the oddities of translation and, you know, the erosion that time brings to our understanding, and we still return to them again and again.
As I hurtled through the night listening to Gould's Book of Fish, I was astonished that anyone could have written it, and I couldn't help but wonder what narcotics you were on.
Yeah, well,
because I wanted some.
I did a very early morning interview with a clearly lost soul who was doing the sort of pre-breakfast shift on Radio Mudgee when the book came out at about 6 o'clock in the morning. It was my first interview. He said, no one's listening to this, mate, but I want to know, where'd you get those drugs? I wrote that in the last year of that was like an extraordinary wild dream, and I would get up earlier and earlier and go to my desk, and I think when writing goes well, you go beyond your own character and your own history, and you discover in yourself the possibility of being all things, all people.
Now, this wasn't an experience that made you feel cannibalised. Clearly you came out of this feeling better.
Well, I enjoyed it at the time. Do I feel better? No, I just think that... I think people know in moments of great physical ecstasy or moments of enormous grief, they have this sense of dissolving into the universe, of being beyond their own personality and history. In everyday life, you can't go there because you would be deemed mad. You wouldn't be able to do your job. You wouldn't be able to get up in the morning. But that's the place you long to go to as a writer, that place that isn't you. I mean, there's the old adage, only write what you know. But if I only wrote what I knew, I'd write very dull books.
I was immensely grateful that you wrote that one. Mm. And I would laugh aloud as I hurtled through the night at a sentence, a paragraph.
Well, look, can I just... I'm glad you said that, because I did a terribly long interview in Germany. And it was very dull. It was a television interview. It went for an hour. And at the end, he said, is there anything else you would like to add? And I said, well, I sort of hoped it might be funny. He says, we don't need to mention that. That's what happens to jokes. It's quite tragic.
As you and I both know, Spike Milligan performed here. Now, I always regarded Spike as at least as great and absurdist as Samuel Beckett, and I'm not joking about that. I think that what Milligan did for millions was what, in a way, Beckett could do for hundreds of thousands. And what Milligan did with words, with images, ideas, was very much like what you did to a loftier purpose, perhaps, in that book.
Well, that's a great compliment. Whenever I think of Spike Milligan, I just think of his headstone where he had written in Gaelic because they wouldn't allow him to have it in English. I told you I was sick.
But you take my point, don't you? Spike was not a happy Vegemite.
I take compliments badly. Yeah. So it's a nice compliment.
Yes, it is. Thank you. And you deserve it. Now, the thing about you which is extraordinary is that all this has happened within a decade. Let me tell the listener who's... it's time for me to do that little routine. This is, apart from a live show at the Theatre Royal in Hobart, this is also Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web. Could you complete that for me, please?
I don't know what comes next.
Downloadable.
The Theatre Royal.
Downloadable onto your pod.
Oh, downloadable.
And... I'm talking to Richard Flanagan. He emerged in Australia in 1961. I happen to think that he was planted here by aliens. He left school at 16, yet somehow wins a Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford. This is about the same time as Malcolm Turnbull.
It was later than Malcolm.
Was it?
Yeah. I think Malcolm saw it as good luck. I saw it as misadventure.
So anyway, here you are, this improbable background. And then bang, 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 out they come. Death of a River Guy, 1997. The Sound of One Hand Clapping, 1998. And I understand that sold 150,000 copies in Australia alone. Now, to contextualise that, this is a country where if you sell 7,000 or 8,000 or 9,000, that's regarded as a bestseller. Then you go on to do Gould's Book of Fish, your fourth novel, The Unknown Terrorist, and now we're sitting here to talk about Wanting. It's a harrowing book, and it has got a cluster of the most extraordinary characters, one of whom we've already identified, and that's Charles Dickens. But there's also the central character of a young Indigenous girl, Mithina. Now, you tell the audience about the painting you saw that helped inspire her character.
Well, I'm often inspired by a single image to write a book. With One Hand Clapping, it was the image of a hydro village that looked like almost like a gulag village in the Urals or somewhere. It was just this snow-ridden set of huts with a little series of telegraph poles with a couple of electric lights hanging off it. With this book, it was seeing a picture of an Aboriginal girl of about 7, a colonial painting, of this beautiful little girl in a Regency red dress, the dress of the Age of Reason, bound with a black velvet band. And I saw it when I was about 20, poking out the back of the Tasmanian Museum here, and the art curator who was showing me through it told me her story, which was tragic. And at the end he said, look at this, and he lifted up the wooden frame, and beneath the wooden frame were these two bare feet. And I think more than anything else, the way they'd used the wooden frame to cut off the sight of those uncivilised feet stayed with me and came to haunt me. And I did think at that moment there was an extraordinary story in this, if I could just come to comprehend it.
So the rest of the novel is like the ripples from a stone dropped in a pool.
It was for me, yeah, to try and understand all that image suggested and spoke about, and the frame around the feet. And, I mean, in the end, perhaps all it is a book about our terrible need for love and the cost to us when we deny that need, that war between bare feet and wooden frames that never ends, within us.
Well, that extends, of course, to Dickens and to the Franklins. Here are people who come from a British culture who are perhaps, amazingly for someone like Dickens, who are afraid of letting loose emotionally.
That's right. I mean, I wanted to write this story, and I even started it a few times, but stories need some leaven, something that pulses through them. And I discovered that Franklin, upon returning to England...
Explain who Franklin was.
So John Franklin was the governor of Tasmania, but he came here with a great reputation. He was the great Arctic explorer of his time. His wife, Lady Jane, was a blue stocking. They were seen to bring culture and civilization to Tasmania, and they adopted this Aboriginal girl, Mathina, and they had this painting made of her. And she was this black princess of Van Diemen's Land. And then when they returned to Britain, they abandoned her. And
So that's a part of the point here, isn't it? They adopt her as a social project rather than an object of love.
Well, I think they... I mean, my book's not history, you know. My book is a...
No, I'm talking about what happens in the novel.
Yeah, in the novel, they really... It is suppressed love on the part of Lady Jane, but she has to dress it up with these ideas of reason and advancement of science and civilization to justify it to herself. But they abandon her. They return to England. Sir John heads off to find the fabled Northwest Passage at the head of the most expensive expedition in British naval history. Promptly vanishes. He was sort of the Forrest Gump of the 19th century, sort of at every critical juncture, but sort of making a bit of a goose of himself. But it became the great mystery of the age. It was sort of a bit like Apollo 13, except it never came back. And finally, after about a decade, an explorer returned from the Arctic wastes with the news he'd garnered from meeting Inuit people that the expedition were all dead, and worse yet, at the end, they'd cannibalised them each other. They'd
like a novelist eating himself.
Yeah, look like a novelist. And Lady Jane, this news rocked the empire because eating people was what savages did. It wasn't what civilised English people did, particularly not the cream of the English Royal Navy. And at that point, Lady Jane was determined to rescue the reputation of her husband, and she called in no less a figure than Charles Dickens to help her. And Dickens was a man who's saw his own life as an exemplary lesson in disciplining what he called his undisciplined heart. And he felt very much that the distance between savagery and civilization was the capacity to control wanting within your own soul. He wrote a very strong piece that had a huge impact, claiming that this account of Franklin's men having turned cannibal was clearly an invention of the Eskimo, and really they'd lied, and the truth was they'd eaten Franklin's men. And this story carried the day. But then a very unusual thing happened. Dickens became completely obsessed with the story of these lost polar explorers, and I think he saw in them an image for his own frozen inner life, because his marriage had turned bad, and he felt ever more distant from his family and from life generally, I think. And he staged a play about polar explorers. And this play was a sensation in Victorian London, and everybody from Queen Victoria down wanted to see it. And Dickens himself was seen to be extraordinary in the starring role as this dying polar explorer. And he reprised the play several months later for some charity performances, and he got in some professional actresses to help him. And he fell in love with one. And I think...
But he fought against falling in love with it, didn't he, in a way?
Well...
As you describe it.
In the novel, I believe, you know, I sort of present him as trying to fight against it and believing it won't happen. And in the novel, I present him as finally realising that in the end reason is a fine thing, but that as he's there lying with his head against her sort of uncorseted belly pulsing.
A soft uncorseted belly,
yeah.
Thank you.
He realises that, yeah, reason's a very fine thing, but wanting is the essence of life. And he undergoes this extraordinary metamorphosis. And it is true that in real life, he emerged from that play a different man. And his marriage ended. He became a couple with this young 18-year-old actress. She had a child to him. And they were a couple unto his death. And his books change, his life changes, and he sort of...
How did his books
become darker, more serious. They lose that there's elements of that comic edge, but they take on a different... They weren't seen to be as popular, although they're the ones that in the 20th century have come to be seen as some of his greatest work.
I'm very comfortable with the fact that you've woven Dickens into this Australian story, and that's one of the great reasons to be here at the Theatre Royal, because it connects with that image of him dying as an actor on stage, the death scene.
Well, Dickens had a great interest in Australia, and they were always offering large sums of money to come here, which tempted him enormously.
Well, it began, in fact, with his sons, who were both jackaroos on the Hay Plains, and they'd write back to him, telling him stories about Australia, sending him clippings, and there's some would argue that it was a story about a Sydney socialite jilted at the altar that led to Miss Havisham. And, of course, there's the other argument, there's a connection between Fagin and Port Arthur.
Well, Fagin's meant to be modelled on Solly... Oh, I've forgotten his second name. But he was a... Solly, who is it? Ikey Solomon. Ikey Solomon, thank you. Yeah, Ikey Solomon.
This is the trouble when you've got a really smart audience.
Yeah.
You see.
Well, I mean, that's the great lie of what I'm doing here, you know. I have to pretend that I'm actually smarter than the audience and the readers. And the dreadful truth is... when you do this, you discover your readers are always smarter than you. I was in a pub not far from here one night, and there was a woman boasting along the bar how she'd slept with the main character out of my first novel, who up until then I thought was a very inadequate invention. And I realised for her he was totally real, and so real, in fact, she had a rather black view of him. But in truth, I don't think a writer ever really understands what they're on about at all. I did a tour, actually, of the USA for Death of a River Guide, which was my first novel, but in that sort of strange way you're published in other countries, it didn't come out till several years later. And when I was flying across the Pacific, I had this sudden panic attack because I couldn't actually remember why I'd written the book, or worse yet, I couldn't even remember the characters' names or much about the story. And so I reached for a drink and another drink, and none of that helped much. And then I landed at LAX, and the publicist was there all excited because she'd just secured this terrific interview with a leading radio journalist who had this syndicated program in America that went for an hour. And we had to go... The only thing was we had to go and do the interview straight away. So I was sort of jet-lagged, hungover and weary, and I was silent as we drove to this radio station. We poured straight in. And I was terrified because I now couldn't remember anything at all about the book. We got in there, and unlike Australia, where journalists aren't always that well prepared, I actually did an interview for The Sound of One Hand Clapping on a Melbourne radio boxing show, who were under some strange illusion as to what the book was about. And my publicist pressed me to take it. But anyway, we got in there, and the North American, he was full of that sort of North American vigour and industry, and he knew everything about the book. He'd actually read it, and he started telling me what the characters' names were and what the story was and all the clever metaphors and symbols, which I didn't even know at the time I was writing it. And so I agreed with him all the way, and it was the best interview I ever did. And at the end, this is terribly, shamefully true, I travelled round the land of the free in that spirit to be immortalised by Barack Obama and his cry, "Yes, we can." And I passed all this journalist insights off as my own motivations and reasons for writing the novel. It was a very successful tour.
Please remind me never to have you on the program again. I won't say who this was, but I often have very difficult interviews with writers who don't seem interested in their own book at all, and who often have forgotten it almost entirely, and so you've got to do both sides of the interview. And, but that sounds like you're a gift from heaven.
Well, it is like de Maupassant said, who remembers a cloud? I mean, these things move you intensely, but it's like trying to describe a great love, a great passion. It is everything that's nothing. It is a very difficult thing. And they do become... The beautiful thing about a book is it becomes alive in that act of grace that's reading, because you put together these awkward sentences, this inadequate dialogue, these poor characters. But if a reader likes your book, they vest it with the authority of their soul and their entire life, and at that moment the book becomes alive. And
what a beautiful thing to say.
Well, that is, I do genuinely believe that's the magic of books, and what I've learned as a writer is more and more to trust to the reader, to not impose your opinions, your... It is, as Chekhov said, your job as a writer is merely to report what your characters do and say, and then it is for the reader and God to judge.
You have no trouble at all getting into the bodies of the Franklins and getting to the body of Dickens. What about understanding or creating black characters? Is that difficult for you?
I think creating any good character is difficult. It's the hardest thing to make one human being vaguely plausible.
That's not the question I'm asking, and you know it isn't. What about when you're dealing with an Indigenous character? Surely that must be far greater, because you've got less experience of that than you have of, say, Dickens even.
Well, I think there is a moment of terror early on when you begin writing novels, when you realise you must count, that there can be nothing that cannot be allowed you, that you must write about any character in any situation or any time. I'm not trying to shy away from your question, but I had a very odd experience early on where I was trying to write Death of a River Guide, and we were completely broke. I was doing labouring jobs and then trying to write up an evening. And I had a friend who was always getting me into trouble, and he'd become the bodyguard for a corporate criminal called John Friedrich, who's largely forgotten today, but who was the first of those 80s sort of crooks to get busted.
And I'm not going to get sued for having this, am I?
Well, he's dead now.
Okay. Get stuck into the bastard.
Well, Friedrich was an amazing story. He'd set up this sort of secret army down Sale, this organisation called the National Safety Council.
I remember now.
Yeah, and he had about 600 men under arms. He had subs. He had helicopter gunships. He had Idi Amin's helicopter. And... for what end?
Kerry Packer bought that later.
Yes. he got away with it because he put it out that the CIA was sort of part of it, and that sort of satisfied everybody. No one asked, the right didn't ask questions, the left thought it was typical, and he kept on just rorting the banks. And in the end, he rorted them for about $700 million. I asked him how he did it. He said, because I was trying to get a house loan at the time, a mortgage. He said, no, mortgage is hard. He said, 700 million's easy. And I think there's some truth in that. But anyway, it finally all collapsed and he went on a run. They had the biggest manhunt in history and they finally caught him near Monkey Mere and extradited him back to Melbourne. And he'd been in the watch house for about 20 minutes when he got a phone call from Harry Miller saying, don't sign anything, I'll cut the deal. And he got this fabulous book deal. And then a year went by and... the publishers began to get rather nervous because he was about to go to court and he hadn't produced anything because he was, you know... Well, he was criminally disposed to put nothing on paper. It was against his best instincts. And so they put editors to work with him and he was awful to them and they'd run out crying after half an hour. And so they said, well, you find a writer. If you won't work with our people, you find a writer. And he didn't know any. And my friend, who was his bodyguard, says, I've got this mate in Tasmania who needs to be a writer. So I got a phone call from Australia's Most Wanted. And so I got $10,000 to write his memoirs in 6 weeks before he went to court. So I flew over to Melbourne, and for some reason it was meant to be top secret, and he'd turn up in disguises each day at the publisher's headquarters. And everyone in the company was told we're editing an anthology of German medieval folk verse. And so he spent about 4 weeks. He was crazy. And then I came back here and he killed himself, which was unfortunate because I still had to finish the manuscript. And it was all written in the first person, you see. And I didn't actually know. I mean, when I started writing it, I'd ask him what he wanted to write, and he didn't have any idea, so I'd make things up and I'd read them out to him. And he'd say, yes, that's how it happened. So And then he would actually ring up people like George Negus and start telling them what I'd just made up and try and cut a deal. But I'm cutting to the chase, so I know we've got to wrap this story up. But anyway...
That's a great story, but it doesn't go near answering the question.
I'm getting back. So I had 2 weeks to finish a book in the first person of a man who is now dead and who I never liked very much anyway in the first place. Anyway, the interesting thing is most writer's first novel is criticised as being autobiographical, but my first autobiography was never criticised for being novelistic. But it didn't do very well because there was a rather mean-spirited campaign to not buy books from crooks, which I thought was a bit unfair on me, really. But anyway, the point of that was I learnt then I had to enter into the spirit of someone completely different from me, and it took me far, far further as a writer than writing several novels would have, because it had to be readable. You know, people had to want to turn the page, and I had to be somebody totally alien to me. And I realised then that's your job, and it is difficult, but you reach into yourself to find everything that isn't you.
This is Late Night Live, ABC Radio National, Radio Australia via the web and podcast, and you're hearing a conversation with Richard Flanagan, recorded yesterday at Hobart's wonderful Theatre Royal. I remember being on air when I heard about the massacre at Port Arthur, and a very distinguished broadcaster, ABC broadcaster, said, "Dear, oh dear, Tasmania has lost its innocence." And I, you know, even though the circumstances were dire, I found it very hard not to laugh aloud. This is an incident that takes place at what is, in effect, a theme park of death in a country, in a state, but then a totally autonomous, extraordinary place, which had more horror, more guilt, more reason to be conscience-ridden, and less innocence than almost any other piece of real estate on the planet. Is this one of the reasons you write here?
Well, let me just address Port Arthur first of all. It is true that that terrible things have happened here. There was a terrible black war, and there was the terrible trauma of convictism. And I think this was a society that was traumatised for over a century after that. And it took a long time, and it's only really started in the last 20 years that it can advance back into the shadows of these horrors and try and come to some understanding so that it might be able to finally head forward. But the 1990s, we didn't really come out of the 1989 recession here. The 90s were a terrible time, and the policies pursued by the Hawke and then Keating government, while they benefited the eastern seaboard cities and benefited Australia, brought unemployment and hard times here. And then Howard had got in, and there were cutbacks in all government departments. There was more unemployment. We were the only state to have ever had a net loss of population in the history of Federation. That went on during that time. And all we had was this myth of goodness. And it was a myth, but it was a good thing.
So
and
you're saying there was a sort of innocence which had been built up?
Well, I think people, you know, that was about all we had, this idea that at least we were good people, and then that was taken from us too. And it was a terrible thing in terms of the death, and it was a terrible thing in the pall it put over a society.
And it's a very powerful point you make. Yeah.
It took years to come out of it. Why do I write here? I think it's because I've only got one lifetime and I've got all these stories I wish to tell, and it's the place I know. And I don't really have another lifetime to learn about another place. And it's not a bad place.
And yet, you are enraged by the state of yours. You fight the political machine as hard as it's possible to do so. Which is why you were just booed loudly by the audience. You seem to think that that this process of change, of purging, is only half done?
I think that's a separate issue. There's been a politics here for the last quarter of a century that has split a very cohesive society in order to keep a few mediocre people in power and to keep a handful of rich and greedy people rich. And
please don't hold back.
Sorry?
I said, please don't hold back.
All I ever did was I felt ashamed because there were so many people here who bravely stood up and were counted and continue to stand up and be counted, and I haven't done very much. And the little I've done was not out of political belief, but in the belief that the truth matters, and if the truth is heard, ultimately that has a power. And that was the small thing I could do. But I think here, for change to come, separate of all that, you know, that of course the past has to be addressed properly and all those things, but the political problems need to be addressed by a Royal Commission. And nothing less than that can establish what went wrong in the past, and nothing less than that can allow us to have a future whereby there can be trust restored in the processes of government, where there can be standards established for proper behaviour amongst politicians, bureaucracy and business.
I was once told during a studio interview by a prominent Conservative politician in New South Wales that to understand the dynamics of New South Welsh politics, you had to understand the Rum Rebellion and its origins. Would you make the same case here, that to understand contemporary politics, you've got to be aware of the very, very dark history that Wanting to some extent addresses?
Well, there is a school of thought here that that we're condemned to this. This is our history, therefore it's our destiny. But if you succumb to that fatalism, there's no hope, and there's always hope, and the world can change, again and again does change for the better, because of the countless acts of goodness and courage by people too easily dismissed as everyday and ordinary. And it will change here because the people want it, and in the end the people will endure in that.
In the last minutes we have together for the programme, for the radio programme, as opposed to the live event at the Theatre Royal, I want to raise your involvement with a little-known film project called Australia. Once again, you get a phone call from Baz Luhrmann and you get swept up in this extraordinary adventure, $150 million worth of adventure. I tried to see the film the other night. It seemed that it was on everywhere and that it was compulsory, so I went down to the local multiplex and it wasn't. So I haven't seen it. Give us your view. You wrote it. How do you feel about your film?
Well, I was co-writer with Baz. I mean, Baz had this enormous ambition and 2,000 shorthorn cattle and Russell Crowe when he asked me to come on, and we just had to find a story, he said, and and so we did. And I think Baz wanted to, what he wanted to do was he wanted to create an epic blockbuster that could take the world in the form of, you know, The Gone with the Winds and The African Queens, but inside it...
Out of Africa, I think, was the film you were looking for.
Oh, well, no, Out of Africa is another one, but African Queen too.
That as well.
Yeah. But, he's very excited by Out of Africa. I mean, he gets excited and he starts... Because he knows these movies off by heart, and he starts doing Meryl Streep, and then he jumps back to Rhett Butler. It gets very confusing, you know. But he wanted to smuggle out this alternative idea of Australia, which would be about the land and which would be about black Australia. And it would be a sugar-coated melodrama because that's the form. But I just love the largeness and boldness of what he was trying to do. And, you know.
Well, you or he, both of you, introduced the idea of the black child as central, which links back to wanting.
Yeah, and this was conceived, you know, the Baz's film was conceived in a very different time in our history, although it was only, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. Those things were seen not to be appropriate material. So I liked the fact that he wanted to take out to the world the story of the Stolen Generations, but in a way that was hopeful, in a way that said this spoke of a future and not just about the past and a good future.
You, of course, made a film yourself. You directed a film of your own book.
Yeah, I did. I like filmmaking. I didn't go much on the politics of film, but it was an interesting thing. The problem with film is that it's a tyranny and the tyrant's money. And I went back and I wrote Gould's Book of Fish, and I sort of got annoyed that films were seen to be a superior form and the only measure of a novel was the option fee you got on it. So I wrote Gould's Book of Fish to be unfilmable, and it's a rather puerile ambition, really. And then, of course, what happened...
I think it's coming out as a Pixar 3D in the Jordan.
Well, Leonardo DiCaprio rang up my agent. He'd fallen in love with it and he wanted to make a movie of it. And she said, you do know that Richard spent 3 years of his life writing an unfilmable novel. And so we didn't sell it because I didn't want to be proven wrong on it. But it was rather childish, really.
You're remarkably young. As I say, you were claimed to have been born in Tasmania in 1961, but that is not my information that you were left here.
Well, I was corrupted early. I remember at our shack, my older brothers coming home with one of your columns, and they just lay in their bunks reading it out aloud about Diogenes. Now, I didn't realise you were allowed to write things like you wrote, and that was quite a transforming moment.
I've had a lot of you characters on the program, haven't I? We could almost devote it to the Flanagan family, really.
There's a lot of us. I mean, I've got 50 first cousins, and it goes on endlessly, really. My poor mother once had 7 cousins turn up because their mother was a bit ill with nerves, and so there were 13 of us, and then most of us went down with chickenpox. And she had my grandmother, who was she was a woman of considerable pretensions and even more hat boxes, and she always took the full front seat of the car, and everyone else had to get in the back. But there were a lot of good stories. We had a cousin... I will finish this one.
No, keep going.
We had a...
Please.
A cousin, Cousin Annie, who was well into her 70s, who came for a couple of days and stayed several months, and she had wonderful stories about the family that went past the Great Sea Wall of the First World War. But she used to love watching Days of Our Lives in the afternoon, and after a while, myself and my younger sister, Jo, started to notice that there were these Mary Lou Flanagans and there were all these American characters creeping into the 19th century Flanagan family history, and in her mind she'd confused Days of Our Lives and family completely. But then we thought the stories were so good we didn't care anyway, and we encouraged her on in this.
I only raised your youth because you've got to pace yourself. You've probably got another 30 or 40 years as a... Yeah, to write novels in, surely.
Well, they take an enormous amount of emotion and energy, and I hope I have. A lot of writers, you know, the great writers do go on, but a lot sort of peter out. I hope I can continue. But
it's a perfectly honourable thing, isn't it, to be a one-book writer, something else we were discussing backstage before. There's been some pretty good novels written by someone who then failed to produce a sequel. One of my favourites is The Leopard of Lampedusa. Well, he didn't live long enough to write a sequel.
Yeah, with Ralph Ellison, The Invisible Man.
Wonderful book.
Yeah,
but, of course, Ellison did write another, and it was burnt in manuscript.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many writers who are crippled, but they realise they've written an extraordinary novel, and they don't know where to go thereafter, and it destroys their lives. It's sad, but perhaps, as you say, that doesn't matter because they give this beautiful gift to the world.
How do you sort of feed yourself culturally? Who do you read?
I'm omnivorous. I read everything, you know. I read Minty wrappers. I like the South Americans. At the moment there's a Chilean novel, Roberto Bolaño, who died in 2003. I think he's the most extraordinary writer I've come across in recent years. But I love those writers who don't have any safety nets, who go for broke, who try and grab on to everything that's constantly dissolving, you know, the memories of their parents crying or laughing, their birth, their, you know, just always going beyond what they can really write and occasionally creating something so vivid and extraordinary.
With your books, are we looking at works that are, at least in your mind, closely interconnected?
Well, like Faulkner said somewhere that you realised at a certain point you're not writing one book but a lifetime of books, and I think you writers you really admire, you come to read all their works and see them as part of the same thing. All the great writers' works are like a 1001 Nights, you know. They merge into a certain view of the universe and the soul.
Baz Luhrmann is belongs to a category of filmmaker who does make films from other films. He cross-references constantly and little acts of homage, I think it's called, crop up. There are writers that write from other writers, and then there are writers that write directly from a more visceral or personal basis. Where are you on that?
Well, I think a writer belongs to two countries. He belongs to the place where he was born and grew up, and that marks you forever. I think Camus said a writer's whole journey in life is to recapture the first two or three images that cross their eye. But you also belong to the universe of books, and you must be open to both those things.
When you wander into Fuller's bookshop, what are you inclined to reach out and purchase these days?
I always drift past...
You're not still nicking them, are you?
Not still throwing them out of the library window.
We can't tell that story. It's a 20-minute story.
I generally go past the front table and I go to the shelves out the back, because so many of the greatest books are the least hyped, and they're often the ones that the cover's in and the spine's out, and I look there. And I just browse endlessly and I listen to what other people tell me. But I'm always looking.
Well, I'm glad you look and I'm glad you write, because I have to tell you, since I belatedly discovered you and we've sort of become reasonably good mates now, I'm lost in awe at what you do, and I hope you keep doing it for years and years and years and years and years, and I also hope you keep sticking it up any recalcitrant or slack government that you happen upon. And congratulations on the new novel. Ladies and gentlemen, this wonderful fellow, Richard Flanagan.
Thank you.
And that ended an evening greatly enjoyed by everyone with Richard Flanagan. It came from Hobart's Theatre Royal. Richard's new novel, Wanting, is published by Knopf, which sounds much more like a sneeze than a publisher. Thanks to the team, Paul Gough, Sarah Konofsky, Chris Short, Kate MacDonald, Sasha Fegan, Ian Townsend and Kathy Gollan. Tomorrow's classic, a conversation on dissent with three dissenting politicians or women. Stick around now on ABC Radio National for the news. See you later.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.